Hey everybody, welcome back to F This Movie, the roaringest, rampagingest podcast.
I'm out of breath.
On the internet. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I am joined tonight by Quentin Tarantino fanboy.
Oh,
by Quentin Tarantino.
That's right, I'm here.
It's kind of like Woody Allen is here with me, pretending to be Quentin Tarantino. I don't know. Anyway, Quentin Tarantino fanboy, Doug.
Hi, Doug. I'm here. I'm a fanboy of Quentin Tarantino's, and I'm happy to be here for F This Movie as part of this beep podcast. That didn't fix it, did it?
I don't know if it did. If you want to visit our website, you can go to fthismovie.blogspot.com. And if you want to send us an email, that's an electronic mail, write us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And if you want to find us in the iTunes store, go to the iTunes store and search F This Movie. And if you want to follow us on Twitter,
that's right.
Go to twitter.com/F This Movie. And if you want to find us on Facebook and become a fan of F This Movie on Facebook,
man, I am falling
asleep. Go to facebook.com/F This Movie.
Okay. Are we done? Are we quite finished?
I'm done. I'm literally finished.
You're finished. I just finished also, but in a very different way.
Tonight, we're talking about Kill Bill.
That's right. Both volumes one and two.
Quentin Tarantino celebrated a birthday recently.
That's right.
Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair, just screened for the first time ever recently at the New Beverly Cinema in California. He's doing a whole week of it.
It screened in the end of, I want to say on his birthday, at the end of March.
Yeah, so awesome. Thanks a lot for only showing it to people in California.
Yeah, thanks for buying the New Beverly and not the Music Box or the Portage or someplace
maybe
in Chicago.
Maybe take that thing around or just put it out on Blu-ray, it's fine.
He also does have a film festival at the Alamo Drafthouse. I think it's called the Quentin Tarantino Film Q-Fest Festival.
Or something.
Like that. Yeah. And it's at the Alamo Drafthouse, which is another awesome theater which I
don't get to go to.
No, so that I want to live like a block from instead of a block from a park, and that doesn't show movies hardly ever.
Rarely. And usually it's like Short Circuit 2, right? It's like stuff that's kind of good, but not that good.
Not anywhere near the caliber of The Whole Bloody Affair. Short Circuit, The Whole Bloody Affair. It's the
that's when they combine Short Circuit and Short Circuit 2.
That's right. Johnny Five is very alive.
So we're talking about Kill Bill because we love it, but obviously before we do,
there's lots of pleasantries to get to.
Yes, and, how are you? How are you sleeping?
Thanks for asking,
Boss Vic Cross. have you seen anything good lately?
I've seen a couple things. I saw Red, which I know I'm Mr. Late to the Party, so please don't judge me too harshly. I saw Red.
You're referring to the third part in the Christoph Kozlowski trilogy.
The white, blue, and red. Is that what it is?
I don't know if it's the third part. I lied, but I just was going for the...
No, I'm referring to the retired and extremely dangerous, which, by the way, Red's a fine...
Oh, so it's like R-A-E-D?
Red's a fine title for a movie.
Not really.
Except until it gets to the point where it's like, oh, it stands for something that's really horrible.
It's not the movie's fault. It's based on a comic book, and that was the name of the comic book.
I blame the movie.
Wow.
So you cannot tell me who to blame.
They should have called it something else.
I'm the boss of myself. I choose my own destiny. I choose my own adventure. I've turned to page four, and I'm blaming the movie.
You're covered in green slime.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
I don't know. Wait, we're going, that's a different... anyway, so I saw Red. Again, I'm late to the party, and it was fine. I remember people kind of raving about this movie.
Yeah.
Not raving. I think that's the wrong word. But people talked about this movie like it was, wow, this movie that came out mid. It was a summer movie, right?
No, it came out in like October.
Oh, then can you cut that?
Which
part
is maybe
out?
Yeah. Which is maybe why people raved about it, because like it felt like a summer movie a few months later, and they're like, oh, neat, I'm having fun at the movies again.
It just seemed like for sure people had no.
I feel like the people that raved about it are people that maybe don't see a ton of movies.
I think that's. Really, really accurate. But I was surprised because I think people expected this movie just to be like a typical whatever movie. And it has some pleasant surprises. But I think conversely, because I saw it so much later, now I'm kind of like, oh, it's overhyped. And I'm just like, I mean, it's fine. Bruce Willis is great. And I love Bruce Willis. And we were talking about this before, too. And I think it's funny to go back and think about the career of Bruce Willis. And in Die Hard specifically, which you just saw recently.
Again, yes, I did.
And that's an excellent, excellent, awesome, perfect movie. And it's funny to think about Bruce Willis in the context of he was a comic actor. He was the star of Moonlighting and would make very kind of silly things. And all of a sudden he's cast against type in Die Hard. And that's all he's been doing by and large, except for little
Cop Out
and North, I suppose.
Oh, yeah, North. See your name on maps. Very impressive.
I hate this movie.
I just saw North. for real, because you and I tried to watch it once years ago and I fell asleep almost instantly, but I watched it on Netflix instant. And for like 20 minutes, I'm kind of with it. And I'm like, I don't understand why Ebert hates this movie so much. And then it just gets so tedious and boring.
Anyway. Let me just clarify also that when Patrick fell asleep, it was very nice because he fell asleep in my arms and I got to watch the movie and he was quiet for once, because usually he's jabbing at the screen.
Why is his name North? Where's he going now? Who's the guy in the bunny costume? What else did Rob Reiner direct? What's that guy from?
What's that? So I saw Red, and it was fine, and it's definitely amusing. It's a little, it knows what it is, and it's you know, kind of in love with its own irony and things like that. But it's good, and I always like to see Bones from the Star Trek reboot, you know, get...
Nice.
Yeah, get some more work.
That dude. I was surprised, really... actually, that Bruce Willis kind of took that part, because I feel like that part ages him a little.
Yeah, he does kind of...
just like old people and Bruce Willis.
Because okay. Morgan Freeman is like, I'm 90, or whatever he says, 80-something in the movie. 90. He's 90.
I'm 90.
I'm 90.
I'm 90.
I'm going to marry my granddaughter.
I'm 90. I'm in a car wreck.
So I saw Red.
This motherfucker.
And I saw... What else did I see? I saw Adventureland. And that movie is excellent. That movie is really great. If you haven't seen it, again, it took me a while to see it, and I assume the same is true for you. So go out and see it. Go borrow it from Patrick, because he owns a Blu-ray, very high-quality disc. And it was very good. I even like Jesse Eisenberg, and sometimes he can rub me the wrong way. Yeah. I loved him in Social Network, but I think that's obviously a mixture of the casting and his personality and Mark Zuckerberg's personality. And I didn't expect to like him in this, because he does definitely play that protagonist, that lead, that charismatic lead that you want to kind of fall in love with and go with him on this journey. And at first I'm like, I don't see myself kind of with this kid, you know, throughout this entire movie. And it works, and he does it really well. And it's a really charming slice of life, very small, absorbable movie.
Yeah, it's good. And it's really good at like nailing down a very specific place and time, which a lot of other movies aren't. Because, like, I think we talked about this after you saw the movie, when it takes place in the 80s.
The late 80s. Which is, I don't see a lot of movies like that, are late 80s.
Right. And usually when a movie wants to signify the 80s or the 50s or the 60s or whatever, it's like you play 10 different songs on the soundtrack, and then you know, oh, this is the 80s. Karma Chameleon is on, it must be the 80s. Someone is dressed like Sonny Crockett, it must be the 80s. Right.
It's all very kind of like Wedding Singer, and even I haven't seen Take Me Home Tonight, but just every character in that. Take Me Home Tonight. Everyone in that seems like they've just kind of like flipped open the book to the 80s.
It's 80s, and this movie actually feels like one person remembered a specific summer in his life and what songs were on the radio and what people were wearing and kind of talking about. And
which
put that on film
is a bigger discussion, because I really think, and if you think about the most successful songs or the most successful movies, they're not the songs or movies that are the broad general stereotypes. It's the ones that are very personal and very specific.
Right.
And even though I've never lived in Pittsburgh and I've never worked in an amusement park and I wasn't at that same age in the late 80s, I can totally identify with these characters, just because it is so personal and it is like very specific, very real crises, you know, though they may be, instead of just like, oh my God, my girl's leaving me for it. Just these broad kind of, you know, drawn with very broad strokes type of comedy or whatever.
And Kristen Stewart is really good in the movie.
Yeah.
And she's not always really good, because she's very mannered and affected.
I almost feel bad for her, because she's saddled with Twilight.
Right.
And I mean, don't get me wrong. You're famous and wealthy based upon this series of crazy books that have been turned into movies, but I do feel like she is a reluctant star. I know that term's used a lot, but it seems like she might really not want it, almost, you know, and I think that we're
so
cynical.
Which is fine if she wasn't bringing that to her performances. Like, you know, she drives me crazy in interviews because she just couldn't seem more just miserable and, she's just twitching and pulling her lip and, like... And that's fine in interviews, like you said, if she's a reluctant star. But she does that in so many of her movies too. That it's like, all right, you gotta, branch out a little bit. But she's really good in Adventureland, I think.
And honestly, you're right. I was thinking too about when you were talking how I think at an MTV Movie Awards she like kissed Robert Pattinson, or it just is like, well, for a person not really wanting to, you know, buy into this hype, like you certainly are giving them a show, you know, of how like tortured you are. But I really want to almost think that she's kind of a reluctant star, and maybe that's, you know, and that's when I see her in Adventureland, and it's like, wow, you're actually, it works in this situation, and I really enjoyed her performance.
Yeah, she's good.
So what have you seen? Anything good lately?
Oh, gosh. I saw Jackass 3. Not in 3D, but I missed Jackass 3 when it was in theaters and finally just saw it. And there's not much to say about it except that I laughed a lot. And I'm not embarrassed about that. Because those movies are really, really funny. And I don't know if it's any like funnier than the other two Jackass movies, but it's at least as funny.
Right. And, man, I haven't seen any of the Jackass stuff in a long, long time, but I know it's one of those things you go back to and it's like, this is really funny. And it totally reminds me, especially the series and the first movie of a very specific time. And actually, in kind of to jump ahead, not to get there too quickly, but talking about Kill Bill, he actually was watching Jackass, which inspired, I think, part of the fight sequence between L Driver and the bride.
Beep. Oh.
Yeah, sorry. No, I went for her, you know. Pseudonym.
We're going to spoil Kill Bill.
I know, right? Spoilers ahead.
Bill dies.
Fuck.
And I also watched, partially inspired by, well, almost entirely inspired by the fact that we were going to be talking about Kill Bill, is this Swedish exploitation movie from the early 70s. And if I was better prepared, I would tell you the exact year.
Hell?
Called Thriller, A Cruel Picture, which is often recut and called Thriller, They Call Her One Eye, which obviously inspired the Daryl Hannah character with the eye patch. And it's, you know, basically just a rape revenge movie that is entirely unpleasant.
Oh,
and
now, I haven't really heard about that movie, but I did hear a lot about Lady Snowblood.
Yeah.
Have you seen this
I've movie never seen Lady Snowblood.
Because apparently, you know, smarter people than me have kind of specifically, in talking about Kill Bill, have said it's almost not verbatim kind of redux, but it's very much an inspiration for just a revenge. A woman's family is killed, which obviously there's a difference right there, too.
Right.
And she goes in this checklist of people that she has to kill for revenge. And I'm actually really curious to see it, but it's so like off the radar. And of course, Quentin Tarantino is famous for his inspirations being so batshit crazy that sometimes they're actually really hard to find, which again is a testament to how much of an auteur he is and how kind of brilliant he is in a lot of ways.
There's an insane amount of knowledge in his head. And yeah, a lot of the movies that he is in love with or is paying homage to aren't available on DVD.
Right.
You know, he owns like the only 16mm print or something, you know. Like,
well, this is also
crazy,
a guy that like
library of
he and his
films.
Friends, you know, be it Robert Rodriguez or Eli Roth or Edgar Wright, like they obviously they made all these the trailers for the Grindhouse stuff, but they're just buddies that like, didn't they buy the new Beverly Cinema in Los Angeles?
Quentin Tarantino is like
a stakeholder?
Part owner,
okay.
Yeah.
And of course, they just go there and have like movie nights. If we, you know, we have a movie club with our friends, and it's like that's what they do. But they, I'm sure, thousands of people want to go there because
if
I lived, you know, in Los Angeles, I would go there. I try to go there all the time.
Well, Tarantino programmed all of March at the New Beverly, and Edgar Wright has done a week before called The Wright Stuff. But yeah, Tarantino did all of March, and it was capped off with a week of Kill Bill: The Whole Bloody Affair. But a lot of the movies he was showing, it was like just double bills of stuff you've never heard of. But like, I would go to every single one because I know that like there is value in it. You know, like if
absolutely.
He picked this, I want to see it because I know that there's going to be something to like about it.
Well, I think full disclosure is that, and Patrick mentioned this before, that I'm a huge fanboy. Patrick is too. And again, if you're listening right now and you're about 13 minutes in and you're thinking like, what's their opinion on Kill Bill or Quentin Tarantino? The facts are, the guy's awesome. This movie is almost flawless, I would say, and just really perfect. And I don't think he's made one bad movie.
I agree.
There's not one thing. Even his segment in Four Rooms or the stuff he would shoot for Sin City, like those are the best parts of the things that they are part of.
Right.
Even though you could say Four Rooms is kind of a piece of garbage, and it kind of is.
Yeah, the movie as a whole definitely is.
His segment, which is not great, it's lesser Tarantino, but it still is like, it stands out above and beyond anything else that even, I think it's famous, in my mind it's famous. We would talk about this obviously for years, and the Robert Rodriguez segment in Four Rooms is always the one, I think when you first saw it, especially for you and me as teenagers or early 20s watching this movie, and that's the one that kind of sticks out because it is the more sensationalistic of the four pieces, but upon rewatching,
it does not hold up, and the Tarantino one does. And the Tarantino one is also interesting even just from a biographical standpoint to sort of see where he was at that point in time, because that's coming right off of Pulp Fiction, and he was this giant rock star, you know, and that's sort of who he's playing, and that's sort of what his whole segment is about. And so that's interesting because then he you know, he faded back a little bit. I mean, Jackie Brown came out, and it's embarrassing to, like, watch on the DVD of Jackie Brown. There's a bunch of, like, promotional stuff and him doing interviews and him talking about Jackie Brown. And he very much, like, went through a phase where apparently he was only watching blaxploitation movies. And he really has this affect on his voice. Oh. And he's just, like, trying really hard to convince you, like, he's down with black people and he's an honorary black guy. And it's right. Like, stop it, stop it. And he has since, you know, let that go. And he's more comfortable just being himself. But
yeah,
it's rough.
And Jackie Brown too, which was, you know, critically acclaimed, and I think for the fans and those who have seen it, like, no one, I don't think anyone really dislikes it, but it definitely did not get the same response.
No, because people went into it wanting Pulp Fiction again, right. And it's not at all. But
it's,
man,
a quieter, smaller movie, but it's not even. I mean, it's so very good.
It's unbelievable. It's one of his best. The thing is with Tarantino movies, for the most part, this isn't true of Death Proof, and this isn't true of Reservoir Dogs, but most of his other movies. While I'm watching them, I'm convinced that it's the best movie that he's done. Like, as I'm watching Jackie Brown, I'm like, well, this is his best movie, and Inglourious Basterds. I'm like, this is absolutely his best movie.
Right.
And I never thought that about Kill Bill. I've always really liked Kill Bill, but I always thought I knew that I liked Inglourious Basterds or Jackie Brown better. But watching Kill Bill 1 and 2 back-to-back yesterday, for the purpose of this podcast, I was definitely like, no, this is the best thing he's ever done. Like, right. I liked it more than I have ever liked it. And I used to always think that the Volume 1, which I've seen a bunch of times, way more than Volume 2.
Because Volume 1 is definitely the more digestible. It's more right. action. It's quicker. It's actually shorter, I think, too.
It is, yeah. I mean, not by a ton, but it is right. shorter. And I always thought, like, Volume 1 is maybe his most rewatchable movie, and Volume 2 is maybe his least rewatchable movie. Hmm. And I don't know that that's true anymore. Again, after watching them yesterday, they're both incredible. And, yeah. and they work even better together.
Yeah. I want to go back to what you were saying before about, I think it's interesting too, just to kind of talk more in the context of the broader Quentin Tarantino universe. Pulp Fiction, I think, also got a negative backlash years after it came out.
Yeah.
And I think that's due in part because it was so successful. It was so, like,
it ruined movies.
Yeah.
But it's not Tarantino's
I'll
fault.
Make a bad yeah. example. Saving Private Ryan. I know that you're not a fan of it. I actually like it a lot. I know it's flawed, but I know that it's still a good movie. And I think that you acknowledge its greatness in certain aspects, but you say
absolutely.
The bads outweigh the goods.
For me.
But it's also one of those movies, it's one of those kind of touchstone benchmark movies where, and it came out in 98 or 99, I think 98.
98, yeah.
And it so kind of changed the war movie, and even the action movie by default, that he's shooting in different camera stocks. It's like this digitization to make it look like very scattered, you know.
Right, even like the fight scenes in Gladiator, which I just rewatched some
oh,
of.
Oh, God, yeah.
It does the same thing as Private Ryan. And again, in Private Ryan, like, no, there was an aesthetic reason for that.
Right.
That it sort of looks like newsreel footage.
Yeah, it's based
know?
Upon the cameras that were
right.
ashore with, you know, the
in
crews
Gladiator,
and the
it makes no sense. It's just
no,
like, remember this from
right.
Saving Private Ryan?
And it's so this thing where all of a sudden you've got this movie that comes out and is so successful and people respect it. And then it's like, well, everyone takes the wrong lessons from it. Like,
right.
well, we're going to use that same thing. And you're right. I remember specifically in Gladiator, like, they're fighting the English or something, and they're the Gauls or the Germans in the north or something. Just like, what is, you can't see anything. He gets
right.
all the wrong editing lessons. Like, it's
right.
this chaos.
Right.
And it's
right.
like, well, it's chaos on Omaha Beach because it's fucking chaos. Like, that
right.
was, I mean, it's documented
right.
as such, you know.
Right.
And I'll even make another really even worse comparison because American Beauty, which came out in 99, does not hold up. But that movie also was one of those movies that came out and people, there were a lot of people that kind of had a love-hate relationship with it, but if nothing else, a lot of the aesthetics of it, specifically the music.
Yeah, definitely.
Kind of like every trailer that came out for the next 2.5, 3 years, were using that same kind of like
right.
glockenspiel, xylophone,
right.
you know, like bag in the wind
yeah.
sound. And it's just like, well, you know, of course you're going to have negative feelings towards it because when it's applied to, when the film stock in Saving Private Ryan is applied to Gladiator, it's like, well, fuck this and fuck
right,
all of it.
Right.
And so likewise when Pulp Fiction, which came out, and rewatch Pulp Fiction because it's awesome.
Yeah.
But when you realize that like that beget all this other these asshole 20-something directors who think they're in the fucking Irish mafia or something, right, that want to do, like, right, Love in a 45, which is not even a bad movie necessarily, but it's like, it so borrows so heavily from
Boondock Saints.
That's
a lot to Pulp Fiction. You know, pre-Pulp Fiction, hipsters were all about Tarantino, and then post-Pulp Fiction, like, if you loved Quentin Tarantino, you were a douchebag.
Right.
You know, you were a poser.
It's the same thing with music, or same thing with anything artistic, where all of a sudden it's like, I found this person. And I remember we actually both saw Reservoir Dogs separately, and we, in high school, were like, you've seen this movie? I've seen this movie. And it was just such a great little connection we had, because not a lot of people had. And it's almost this thing where a band, it's like, I heard this bootleg of a band, and all of a sudden when they're on Conan O'Brien, or, you know, like, they're headlining Lollapalooza, it's like, well, fuck that band, you know, like, they've sold out. And it's like, if nothing else, we should be happy that now these people can make more songs or movies and are able to pay their fucking bills to do something that they love, which makes us happy.
Right.
But there is definitely a backlash for Pulp Fiction where, you know, people loved it, and then it was like, whoa, oh, my dad saw it. No, I can't like it then. And it got an Oscar for best screenplay. It's like, no thanks, you know.
And people do kind of forget how awesome that movie is.
Yeah. But
Thank God that movie exists, because now we've gotten several other incredible movies out of it, and obviously right now we're talking about Kill Bill, which we recently did a show on Zack Snyder, visionary director Zack Snyder's Sucker Punch.
Zack Snyder, visionary director.
And there's a lot of similarities between Kill Bill and Sucker Punch, not necessarily stylistically or thematically or whatever, except that it's about, like, girls that fight. But just in the way that Sucker Punch is obviously this crazy mashup of all of Zack Snyder's interests and fetishes and stuff, Kill Bill is the same for Tarantino. It's like, it's all those movies that he has seen and loved that you've never heard of that aren't on DVD.
Right, it's what we're saying about Quentin Tarantino just being such a kind of a savant with all these movies. Right, it's like, well, just because you haven't seen it, and you see it at Kill Bill, and it's so new and fresh, but doesn't mean it's not inspired by something else.
Right. I mean, he's just ripped off so many things and put them together, and obviously in a much more successful way than Zack Snyder did with Sucker Punch, because Kill Bill feels like a movie, there's a story, there's incredible performances, there's great dialogue, he really shoots action well. Mm-hmm. And I was really impressed rewatching it yesterday. The way that he shoots action, it's like, it's all done in these, it's rarely done in, like, long, wide shots. It's all cut up. So you'll get, like, one beat of action, and then it cuts to the next thing. You know what I mean? That it's almost like in these single shots.
That's funny, because I remember I watched it yesterday also for the purposes of this podcast. And there is a thing where, like, L Driver, the Daryl Hannah character, will punch the bride.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just literally, like, fist in face.
Right.
And the next shot is, like, her flying backwards, and Daryl Hannah's up.
Right.
And it's like she was laying down. It's so you don't get. It's not this fluid thing. It's just
it's all kind of chopped up, and it's a way that you don't typically see action in movies, and so even that is kind of exciting to watch.
It's different too, because I think you could point to Zack Snyder's Sucker Punch or a lot of the action movies where it's so, I don't know if claustrophobic is the right word, but it's so just like the camera's so in the middle of it that you don't know what's going on because it's spinning around. There's a billion cuts, like Michael Bay,
right?
And it's hard to watch. Whereas Quentin Tarantino, it's not hard to watch, but there's similar things in that you don't need to necessarily see every beat,
mm-hmm.
but he does it in such a way where you still understand you're grounded in where you're at, like as a viewer, with mm-hmm. Where the camera is, where the two characters are, you know exactly what's going on. He just knows how to do it. I think that's probably due in part to watching a lot of the old Hong Kong films and the kung fu stuff. So,
if nothing else, Kill Bill begat the career of Zoe Bell, so we should love it for that
reason. It is funny because I love Zoe Bell, and I know you do, and you kind of brought her to my attention. Obviously, she's the star of his segment, Death Proof and Grindhouse. But it was funny because I'm watching Kill Bill, and I don't think I've seen Kill Bill since I've seen Death Proof.
Okay.
And I was like, I bet that's Zoe Bell. You know, it's like, because it's Uma Thurman, like, walking on the bride character walking on a railing fighting Lucy Liu, and it's like, her legs are, that girl's legs are a little shorter, because, Uma Thurman is like this, praying mantis. And
there's
there's
a great documentary called Double Dare about Zoe Bell, and this is embarrassing. It's an older Jeannie Epper, I want to say is
Evel
her name.
Knievel.
She's an older stunt woman. She used to play Linda Carter's stunt double on Wonder Woman, and she actually shows up in Kill Bill Volume 2. She's the pastor's wife in the church.
Okay.
The pastor is Bo Svenson from the original Inglourious Bastards. Jeannie Epper, I think, is her name. She plays the wife. And it's about the two of them. And it's specifically the point in time where Zoe Bell is working on Xena Warrior Princess in New Zealand and is picked by Tarantino to come shoot Kill Bill, and it follows her through the making of Kill Bill. And it's great. It used to be on Netflix Instant. I don't think it is anymore, but it's still available through Netflix, so everybody should check it out, especially if you love Zoe Bell as much as I do. Double Dare. And there's also a lot of cool backstage stuff about the making of Kill Bill. So that's if you're a Kill Bill fan, you should see it also.
How awesome is Zoe Bell, though, too, where she's, if you've seen Death Proof, another great Quentin Tarantino movie, it's such a small little thing that he's, it's not, you know, it's not a big statement movie, but this is so great. We talked about this before on the Grindhouse podcast. But Zoe Bell is so charming and just cute and sweet and not even like the sexiest thing ever, but just everything about her personality just oozes charisma and just you want to like... You know, and watch her.
And if you see Double Dare, that is all true of her in real life.
So she's not like, really acting. She's just like she's such a great
person.
She's
so
great. So by now, if you haven't figured out, you should definitely watch the or listen to the Grindhouse podcast and also the Sucker Punch podcast because we kind of came out, Patrick more specifically than me, but came out in defense of Sucker Punch.
Yeah.
Because it had like what Zack Snyder was trying to do and kind of, you know, failed in some ways and succeeds in some other ways and maybe will be acknowledged later in history. Quentin Tarantino does succeed on all counts right away, and it's there's no debate about it. So,
well, there's this whole notion of, you know, people have a real problem with Sucker Punch about the female empowerment issue and, like, how can you say they're being empowered? They're fighting with swords and kicking, you know, the asses of all these guys, but they're doing it in their underwear, and so men are enjoying it. They're being
exploited
sexually.
I heard something, too, about that, like, it's all through the male gaze and, like, how the men are always still
you're getting
in control.
Into just crazy Carol Clover stuff, but, like, Kill Bill, not that it's necessarily about female empowerment, although when you look back at Tarantino's filmography, like, he really writes strong roles for women, whether it's Jackie Brown, which technically I guess is Elmore Leonard, but Death Proof is like an incredibly feminist sort of horror movie. And Kill Bill, what I like about Kill Bill, if you're talking about like the feminist perspective, is, you know, there's a tendency to, when you say that a female is empowered, when you talk about like Charlie's Angels, it's because like, she's friends with girls and she can do all the things that men do. Like, she beats people up, and that's what guys do, that somehow to be empowered as a woman, you have to be more like a man. Hmm. And the bride is certainly very capable physically and kicks much ass, which obviously we'll talk about, but like Tarantino writes it so that it's not at the, she doesn't have to sacrifice, what makes her a woman specifically sort of, you know, not that maternal instincts are the only thing that make you a woman, but like she's so maternal and that's sort of what the whole movie is building towards. And you don't necessarily realize it
until
you see it all the way through.
Watching the movie, especially the first part by itself, if you've only seen it, and obviously the first part came out in 2003 and the second part came out in 2004. If you just saw the first part in 2003, you really wouldn't know why there's this whole vendetta. Why, I mean, obviously that she was, you know, her wedding party, her fiance, the reverend's wife, the organ player played by Sam Jackson, they're all murdered by the deadly Viper assassin squad. And she wants to get revenge, but you don't know why they're, it's a lot of like unknowns and things like that, which just makes it so great when you watch the second one and kind of realize why this is. And, you know, and a lot of it is based upon the fact that she wants to leave that life and be a mom.
And work at a record store.
Right.
But then she has that great scene. Again, spoilers for Kill Bill. If you haven't seen it, you're crazy. But like during that incredible last scene she has with David Carradine, which is what makes the entire 4-hour movie work.
Right.
And he gives her like truth serum basically. And he says like, did you really think your new life was going to work? And she tries so hard not to say it, but she says no. And it's so great. She's so good in the movie.
Yeah, she really is. Do you think that this is going to sound so catty and gossipy? Do you think, I mean, obviously Quentin Tarantino and Uma Thurman had a relationship, right?
No, that's never been.
I know, but it seems specified. Like they, I mean, again, the movie is like story by Q and U.
Yeah,
it's like
right.
Quentin and Uma.
Right.
And I know that obviously when they made, they've only made the two movies, Pulp Fiction and the Kill Bill volumes. I know that like they like this is something that they like workshop together almost the story, the character of the bride, all the you know kind of the offshoots of all that stuff. I just am so curious is like did they ever hook up? Did they? I know she was with Ethan Hawke during that time too.
Right.
I think during Pulp Fiction specifically, I think they had broken up. Maybe not. Maybe they were still together. Again, this is the gossipy name cast.
Well, I think it's obvious that like in one way or another, Tarantino was sort of in love with her. I think you can only right. create this movie around her if you are sort of in love with her, whether it's romantic love or whatever, I don't know, but right. it's obvious that he sort of worships her in this movie, and that's right for the movie. Watching it again, you know, when the movie came out, obviously because we're big Tarantino fans, you know, I sort of wanted to know as much about it as possible. So I would read interviews and watch the trailers, and I just would research it because I was excited about it coming out. So going into it, I knew a lot of what to expect. I knew what it was about, and I knew what kind of movie it was going to be. But as I watched it yesterday, I was thinking about, like, okay, what if I knew nothing about this movie?
Right.
Because the way that Volume 1 opens, there's the black and white thing, which is just so jarring. And I remember that gunshot the first time I saw it was like, oh my god. And then there's that great credit sequence with the Nancy Sinatra song. But the way that the movie really opens is a car pulling up to Vivica A. Fox's house. She opens the door and they start fighting, and it's like, right. who are these people? Why are they fighting?
Right.
And you're immediately invested. And again, probably because I knew who they were going in, right. because of the marketing and everything. Right. But like that's the way the movie opens, just with a fight between these two people.
But that's definitely how Quentin Tarantino kind of like wants to kind of shake you and grab you and pull you and suck you in. I mean, it's his whole style, I guess, of doing things. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's so much about her character, the bride. And I think to myself about Uma Thurman, like, she's so talented. And you don't see it that often, and partially because she just doesn't make a lot of movies.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's just a more about her choices, and if that's the case, awesome. Because if she's making choices like, you know what, I'd prefer to do stuff like Kill Bill or Pulp Fiction and things like that, and I'll pass on the How Do You Know type movies, awesome. But of course, as fans, you kind of want to see her in other movies, but also don't want to have to deal with the disappointment.
Well, maybe you've never heard of a movie called My Super Ex-Girlfriend.
Oh, fuck. She was right.
She's on a run lately. The Accidental Husband, Motherhood, Prime.
What the fuck? What am I thinking of then?
She's,
I was thinking that she wasn't in,
like,
that.
Almost anything post-Kill Bill has been miserable.
Because to your point about her in the Truth Serum, when she is like struggling to say, she wants to say yes. Like, she's starting to nod yes, and you see her mouth forming a Y.
Right.
And she says no, and it's like, oh my god.
I'll back up even further, because, you know, the movies sort of get a bad rap amongst Tarantino bashers, or even people who like Tarantino but who write these movies off as just mixtape garbage. That it's just the sum of his influences. And they say it's not about anything; it's just about the style and the ripoffs and all that. Okay, fine. And on the surface, that's, you know, what you can see. But there is a moment very early on in Volume 1. It's after all the fighting and the pussy wagon, and there's all this wacky stuff, but that exists in the same movie with her waking up in the hospital bed and realizing that her kid is gone.
Right.
And letting out this scream that's so hard to watch every time I see it, because it's so, like, raw and real, and it's so great, and it's a testament to her performance and the fact that Tarantino is willing to put, you know, real emotion into this movie that is otherwise this crazy stylistic mashup. That,
right,
you know,
right.
Just this
violent, right. That's the same movie where she's like training with Pai Mei or whatever his name is in China or Hong Kong.
Right.
And that's like a cartoon almost,
right.
But it's so great. I don't get me wrong. I love that sequence, but it's like that juxtaposed with that scream, that primal, like, I've lost my baby scream is definitely, it's the two sides of the same coin, I guess.
The emotions in the movie are so real.
Right.
Whether it's the scene between Michael Madsen and David Carradine, or especially the scene at the end with Carradine and Uma Thurman, where it's so great, and they have this whole history between them that you sense, even though you aren't, you know, you're told a little bit of it, you see some of it, that scene outside the wedding that kicks off Volume 2. All those scenes are incredible, and they fill in such history. You know, you only get a lot of the characters that aren't Uma Thurman only get a few scenes each, and yet they fill in so much backstory just with their performances, and they're so, everyone is so good in the movies, and, you know, that is something that Tarantino gets credit for a lot, that he picks these actors who aren't, you know, they're not nobodies, but
well, they're Michael Madsen,
or they're Travolta in Pulp Fiction, or they're Pam Grier and Robert Forster. How awesome is Robert Forster and Jackie Brown? They're actors,
and then
he
made My Super Ex-Girlfriend.
they're actors that, you know, Tarantino knows, but people have sort of forgotten about. But I mean, Vivica A. Fox and Lucy Liu, those aren't the people that you would think are going to be in this awesome movie.
You know, honestly, I can only think of, like, Vivica A. Fox came on the scene to me as in Independence Day. That was like her right. breakout performance. And right. since then, she's not made anything really big, I don't think.
Or anything really good, at least, you know.
I'm even thinking, yeah.
Because she's acting all the time, but it's almost always bad. You remember her in Idle Hands. Come on. And Lucy Liu, you know, she was kind of a TV actress. And, like, David Carradine.
I loved her in Flypaper.
You know, David Carradine was supposed to be... Warren Beatty was supposed to play Bill.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say, you know, would that have been
great? I think it would have been a different movie.
It would have been different because I can't imagine... I can't say it would be better because...
No, absolutely not. It just would have been different. I think that even Tarantino said if it was Warren Beatty, it would have been a different character. Like, it would have been more suave, like a spy, James Bond type thing, as opposed to this Carradine being like a, I don't know, Southwest, you know,
he's
assassin.
Unbelievable.
He really is. And even his, like, weird affects and, like, his own, like... real things like his lisp, but it works, you know.
Right.
But to what you were saying before about their relationship, it's so interesting because you find out so much about them, but it really you don't find out until the very near the very end.
Mm-hmm.
B, a lot of it is through interactions with other people, not their like dialogue one on one. And when they finally do talk to each other, you don't really get to know too much more about them. But you know everything about them, everything that you need to know about them. Like, you don't care how they met, you don't care whatever, you just know that they're like, they one time, like, she was in love with him, he probably used her a little, you know, it's this whole back and forth, but he was in love with her, and it's just, you know, it's a very complex thing that the movie gives us credit for just understanding, and a lot of other movies don't, because they say, well, you have to either love someone or hate someone, it's black and white, and this movie is nothing but gray.
And it's you know, it's 4 hours building up to her wanting to kill this guy. The title of the fucking movie is Kill Bill.
Right.
But before she does, they have this half-hour dialogue scene.
Right.
Again, spoilers for Kill Bill. The fight is very short.
Right.
And then even after she delivers the fatal blow, they go back to who they were. And they have this little moment together that's like...
Right, you never see that. You never see that in movies.
Oh, man, is it good.
Right. Oh, shit, we're just evolving into...
Really, it's the...
Quentin Tarantino's so great.
It's the Chris Farley show. All right, but let me say there's one thing in the four-hour movie that I'm not crazy about, and it sticks out to me every time. I used to think that Volume 2, like I said, was harder to watch because it's a little bit slower. There's longer dialogue scenes. It's more... the first movie is much more of like a sort of a kung fu movie, and the second movie is more of like a slower kind of spaghetti western.
Well, it's more about characters, the second one, right?
And it's that's necessary, and it's amazing that if he was going to do this all as one movie, that's how he structured the movie, that you watch 2 hours before you really start to fill in any of the backstory. So watching Volume 2 again, it's great, and I love all the dialogue scenes, and I love all the performances. The scene that always... slows the movie down for me. You know, Tarantino loves these character actors and he loves giving them these great parts, and that's fine, but sometimes it goes a little too far because the second performance given by Michael Parks, he shows up in Volume 1 as Earl McGraw, a character he's played in From Dusk Till Dawn and in Death Proof and in Planet Terror and again in Kill Bill.
That's his real son, by the way, too, right?
Yeah.
Son number one.
Who, again, shows up in, is that Death Proof?
I think so, yeah.
When they're in the hospital. Marley Shelton comes storming out, just a little, and they like, have the whole conversation about Hooper, or whatever he calls him.
And he plays the Ricardo Montalban character.
Right.
I forgot his name.
I forget, but he mentions, like, the Acuna Boys, right?
Yeah.
Which is the name of the Mexican restaurant
right.
in the commercial in Grindhouse.
Uma Thurman's character goes to visit
right.
this friend of Bill's in Mexico.
And the point of the scene she has to find out where is Bill.
Right, he runs a whorehouse, or did, he's retired, he's an older Mexican gentleman, and it's just a very, it is kind of like this.
It's not a bad scene, and his performance is good and interesting, especially when you realize that that's Michael Parks, you know, who already played a role.
I didn't even realize, honestly, I was like, at the end of the movie, I'm like, oh, I don't even know, because it is like, the performance is really excellent.
It is good, but it's like, it's too long of a scene, too slow of a scene, too almost unnecessary of a scene at that point in the movie,
you know, it's funny,
I think.
You bring it up because I brought it up too last night to Shadia. I was like, why do you think this scene is in here?
Mm-hmm.
And Shadia said to me, she's like, well, they need a beat before you get to Bill's house, you
mm-hmm.
know, or basically until the end. And I'm like, yeah. And that satisfied me enough to
mm-hmm.
like, yeah, that obviously is the reason why this is here. But it does kind of stick out to your point. And I swear to God, that's a true story, because I'm not just piggybacking on what you said. It was like, it's one of those things that kind of sticks out. Is like, well, does this need to be here? And I'll even say, not to jump ahead, after the sequence with Bill and the bride, in which Uma Thurman's character kills Bill.
Whoa.
Spoiler. There's a scene, the very last scene.
Yeah.
Do you think that scene is necessary? Do you think that scene, like, where she's in the... It's a scene where she reconnects with her daughter. That's another spoiler, that her daughter's alive.
Yeah.
So basically, Uma Thurman was pregnant when she was shot in the head. She thought her baby was lost for the first entire movie, in the first half of the second movie, I think.
No, up until she walks in the
house. Oh, that's right, yeah. And then
which is another just unbelievable reaction shot.
Right. And then she discovers that she has a daughter, and then she kills Bill, and then she leaves with the daughter. And the last scene is they're in a hotel room, and Uma Thurman is crying in a bathroom apart from her daughter, and she's hugging this lion stuffed animal. And then the daughter's watching Heckle and Jekyll, I think.
Yeah.
And she comes out.
Another example of characters always in movies watching things that they wouldn't watch.
Well, right. Yeah. Oh, God. There's a part of that, too, in Goodfellas. They're watching Al Jolson when the FBI agents show up. You know what I'm talking about? That one scene where it's where the FBI agents show up to Henry Hill's house.
Right.
The wife lets him in.
I don't remember.
And Al Jolson's on TV. And he's like whistling through his hands. And I'm like, what does this have to do with it? Is this just Martin Scorsese being crazy?
Right.
Anyway, so yeah, they're watching Heckle and Jekyll's on the TV. And she comes outside from the bathroom and she hugs her daughter and it says the lioness is reunited with her cub.
Right.
And the thing to me just seems like, I guess it's a nice coda, but it just...
I think it's necessary only in the sense that, and I wouldn't say it was necessary if it wasn't for that scene where she's laying on the floor, this mixture of crying and laughing.
Yeah.
Because like that's...
another example of...
Right. Because that's where I think it really comes together of, like that... That's what all this was for. That you need to see her be happy, sort of. She spent 4 hours getting revenge.
And getting her ass kicked, too.
Yeah, and you think that the revenge is the point. Once I kill everybody, I'll be happy, I'll be satisfied. And you realize, no, that's not the case.
Right.
What all this was for her to be reunited with her daughter and to be happy again, to not just feel empty, this empty vessel of, you know, vengeance.
Right.
So I do think that's necessary, that we see what all this was for. And I like that scene. I don't know.
No, I don't dislike it, but I just it kind of stuck out to me as like I mean, only as like a watcher of the movie, only as like a theater goer, I'm kind of thinking, well, and everything you said is true and everything you said kind of makes sense, but it just seems to me like the point of the movie is to, I mean, it's called Kill Bill, so it's like, you know, she kills Bill, and it's like she takes her daughter. And to me, it would almost work, too, if she just swept up her daughter and, like, walked off and got in a car and they drove away.
But sure.
You need the moment where she is, like, happy and kind of has this...
I don't need it, but it reframes the movie for me. Okay. That it's not about killing Bill.
Right.
But that's actually not the point of the movie. You think it is for 4 hours, but then it turns out to be something very different.
Everything told me it was. Everything about this movie told me it was about killing Bill.
You know, the movie can obviously be broken up into these set pieces. I mean, it's broken down by chapters.
Right.
And it's very much like a sequence-heavy movie. And that's the only reason I point to that second Michael Park scene as, like, the only sort of set piece that doesn't work entirely for me.
Well,
I don't want to get rid of it.
There's a couple other things in the movie, too, like where the Michael Madsen character, the Sidewinder Bud character, he goes to his work.
Yeah.
And, like, he sees his boss, and his boss is pissed at him, and it's like...
Right.
If nothing else, it's like it shows that, I think it was Miramax, because before the Weinsteins left Miramax, it was a Miramax movie, and they just gave Quentin Tarantino like carte blanche, do whatever you want.
Right.
That basically the director was able to do, like, put the scenes in he wants in, and no one is kind of over his shoulder saying, like, cut this out, trim it down, blah blah blah.
Right.
Aside from the fact to break it into two
right.
movie parts, that obviously being a very huge stylistic choice that
right.
kind of maybe fucked
right.
with the director's mind. But other than that, it seems like he's pretty much able to do whatever he wants. And even that scene, like, I don't even mind it, but it just seems to me like I don't need to learn about Bud necessarily.
Right. Except that, like, I think, you know, he's just a fan or a friend of Larry Bishop, I think is the guy that plays his boss. And so he gets, you know, it's just another interesting character actor in the movie, but also, you know, you don't necessarily get a sense of, no, I take that back. You do get a sense of who these people are sort of after the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad broke up. You see that Lucy Liu has become like a Yakuza boss, you
right.
know, And Daryl Hannah is basically still just working with Bill, doing whatever. She's sort of his assistant or his, you know,
right,
his hatchet man. And Vivica A. Fox obviously has relocated to the suburbs and is trying to put that life behind
her. Which is interesting, too, because she's doing pretty much exactly what the bride wants to do with her life. And for whatever reason, she gets away with it.
Right. And Bud obviously has this shit existence, and this thought isn't original to me, so I apologize, but I don't remember where I read it, but that Bud is the only one who shows genuine remorse, who acknowledges, like, no, she deserves to get revenge, we deserve to die, and that his existence, living in the trailer and working at this awful job, is almost like a self-imposed punishment.
Mm.
So I think that's an interesting way to look at it, and then that... it makes that scene make sense to me.
It's interesting, too, in that Daryl Hannah is pissed off at Bud because Bud, you know, in quotes, kills the bride.
Right.
And that she says, you know, I can't believe, like, I don't, I, there's a whole scene where he asks, like, do you regret?
Right.
Or are you
which R are you?
Right. One? Regret or, what's the other R? I forget.
Really?
Relieved?
Really?
Relieved,
hungry?
Is it?
Maybe, yeah.
Regret or relieved that that Bellatrix is dead. And she said both, and he's like, which
it's
one
Beatrix,
are you?
Isn't it?
Bellatrix is from Harry Potter. Fuck my face. So yeah, which one are you and whatever. But she makes a point where she's like, I can't believe, and they all respect the bride, obviously. Beatrix, right. Not Bellatrix. Not Helena Bonham Carter's character. Now, she doesn't do magic. I actually think Daryl Hannah is probably the weakest of all the characters. Maybe just her acting, and I don't know. Like, I don't want to rip on any person's performance in this awesome, awesome movie. But she comes across as just like, I'm playing a character in a Quentin Tarantino movie, whereas everyone else seems to fit really naturally in the movie. I also did some dumb research, and I'll let you respond to that if you want. Okay. Because I know that is very much my opinion, and the look on your face made it seem like it wasn't your opinion.
Well, there's always that line that stands out to me that's very acted, but I know she's directed that way, where she says, that's right, I killed your master. And it's like, that moment is in there because that moment is in all those movies,
right.
And it's heightened for that reason. It doesn't feel natural, whereas the rest of the scene does, at least the dialogue, not so much the fighting.
It feels natural in as much as this is the movie we're getting.
Right, you know? Right.
But it's interesting, this is going to sound so dumb, but this is a testament to Quentin Tarantino's crazy, savant, autistic attention to detail, his focus, and his knowledge of movies. We've talked before about his love of spaghetti westerns and kung fu movies and the Yakuza stuff and all these. I mean, it's a mixture of Chinese, Japanese, Italian, Western, like, blaxploitation, even in this movie still. Mm-hmm. And he's also, his attention to, like, these weird kind of facts and details, like, they're all named after snakes. And that the only snake that's not indigenous to North America is the Black Mamba, played by the bride, or the bride's character. It's also the most poisonous snake. And the only snake of all of their names, I mean, there's Copperhead, Black Mamba, Sidewinder, the only one that's not poisonous is the California Mountain Snake, and that's Daryl Hannah's character. And there's a scene, too, and this is so nerdy fanboy, but like, where she's about to poison
the
bride in the hospital when she's in a coma, and she can't do it. She's saved by a phone call, but she can't poison her. She's unable to kill. And even when Daryl Hannah's character, spoiler, kills Michael Madsen's character, it's actually the Black Mamba that kills it, you know, which is the bride's code name. So it's like Quentin Tarantino just being like, I don't know if he thought these things like as he first started to write, but it all kind of fit together.
Yeah.
And we talked about this briefly on the phone today, because there's another scene in which Bill shows up at Bud's trailer, and behind Bill there's a car, and it's this old, really stylized, very futuristic, awesome-looking car. And I researched because I'm like, what the hell car is this? And it turned out to be this Italian prototype car that was never in production, but its name in Italian means mongoose, and mongoose is the only thing that eats these, like, black mambas and these snakes. And it's just like, who the fuck thinks of these things? And again, if you're Quentin Tarantino, you do all the time.
Right.
That's all you think about.
Right.
And that's what makes these movies so excellent and so much more, like, you watch any other movie, and even Sucker Punch, and I'm not going to rip on Sucker Punch because everyone and their fucking mom is ripping on Sucker Punch right now, but there's just not that attention to detail in that, or in anything, in The Proposal, in MacGruber. There's just no one cares about where the backstories of these things are. And believe me, I'm not a huge fan of backstories for when they're unnecessary, but when they have these little things and they're not, you're not beaten over the head with it, it really kind of fleshes it out. And for fans who want to watch the director commentary, who want to watch these documentaries, it's like, man, you just kind of sit back and are enveloped by this experience.
Right. When when we used to do some acting, just like in community theater and stuff, sometimes directors would
delete this part. What are you talking about?
Sometimes directors would have us sit down and like write a backstory for our character.
Yeah, that
and it's this stupid masturbatory exercise that does no one any good.
Well, because it's a fucking community theater director, you know, who's an idiot, you know, trying to be Stanislavski or Strasberg or something. It's like,
but Tarantino knows these characters' entire lives, and it comes through in really small ways. The movie doesn't necessarily stop to fill in. I think of that scene, like that barbecue scene in Taken, where all of a sudden everyone just starts recounting a story the way no one does in life. Right. Oh yeah, and then you did this, and then those were crazy times, and just like, what?
It took me like probably 6 seconds to even remember that bad scene, because Taken, by the way, is not a good movie. Taken is very watchable.
But that's the worst scene
in Taken.
And it's
a fun movie, but yeah, it's a scene where he gets together with his mercenary buddies from way back when.
So that we understand what he used to do, and you know, and it's just shoehorned in there, and there's no scenes like that in Kill Bill, but you still get a sense of who these people have always been and what they've done and
reminds
where they've been.
The scene in Blues Brothers too, where they're comparing prison food, you know, it's like, can't be as bad as the Salisbury steak in Cook County.
When I saw Volume 2 the first time, I remember feeling sort of let down.
Can you please explain the context and the story in which you saw Volume 2? Would that wasn't the first
that
time?
That was not the first time.
What?
No. I saw it the day it opened.
What?
But I saw it a second time.
Please explain.
For my bachelor party as planned by Doug.
Thank you.
We went to a theater in St. Charles where it was supposed to be like a Brew and View kind of thing where they served alcohol and showed a movie.
This old theater, the theater is still there, but I think this place is now...
I don't think
totally
they show movies. Yeah.
Right, I think it's like they have plays there. It's a place that used I assume it's still called the Arcadia.
Yeah.
So in St. Charles, Illinois, this Arcadia Theater was like the Vic. It was like the Brew and View. And we had a whole busload of guys go out there, and I'm like, Patrick loves movies. This is perfect for his bachelor party because we'll get some food first. We'll go there for people that want to drink. They can have beers at the bar, and we'll watch Kill Bill Volume 2.
The wrong Kill Bill to watch.
And it definitely is like, I think some people fell asleep.
Yeah, well, people have been drinking and stuff, but it's like, oh, there's a lot of talking in this movie. And like,
you kind of become hyper aware of that stuff,
too. Volume 1, obviously, is all the craziness and fighting and violence, and it's like, woo, that one's fun. But, you know, the theater was pretty empty, too, which I'm sure didn't help. The first time I saw Volume 2, I remember feeling let down that Michael Madsen was sort of killed off by Daryl Hannah, by the snake, and not by Uma Thurman. Because, but I don't know, looking back on that, and even knowing that that's a Black Mamba, I don't think I realized that, so obviously
like it's symbolically her.
Exactly.
Right?
But, you know, he comes the closest to sort of dispatching her, and he's the one who almost wants to the least. He's the only one who feels like, yeah, we deserve to die, she deserves to have revenge, but he still puts up a fight when she comes to kill him.
It doesn't mean he's not going to, like, fight back or try to put her in the
ground.
And
he comes the closest to actually killing her. But and ultimately he's killed off by somebody else. But it's weird because you do get like hypered up into this sort of bloodlust where you want to see her take revenge on all these people.
Absolutely.
You know,
It's interesting too. That whole scene with Michael Madsen as Bud, and he shoots her in the chest with rock salt and a shotgun.
Eesh.
And then he drugs her and then he buries her alive.
Yeah.
And that's a hard scene to watch.
And when I saw that in the theater, and I was trying to do some work while I watched it at home, but this doesn't happen on the DVD or the Blu-ray, right? I swear, and maybe I'm remembering this wrong, and if you remember differently, afthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. When I saw that in the theater, the shots of her in the coffin, the aspect ratio changed.
The aspect ratio changed, but not in the coffin, but it was weird, because on my DVDs,
okay.
I don't have Blu-ray, I have DVDs, watching yesterday, the aspect ratio was different when she was in the back of his truck. As she was like being driven to the cemetery, and then he yanks her out, and it goes again back to widescreen.
So maybe I just was looking down. I thought it was when she was buried that it switched to like.
I wish it did, because it almost seems to make more sense there. Because definitely, it's so dark, and it was like, no, she is like knocked out, and she's like being taken to the gravestone of Paula Schultz, which I guess is an homage to a movie called the Weird Dream or the Weird Dreams of Paula Schultz from 1968, starring the cast of Hogan's Heroes. Because here's me today, like, doing research, because I'm like, why would Paula Schultz, just sticks out in my mind, why would he do, because you know that everything in there is deliberate. There's nothing in a Quentin Tarantino movie that's not deliberate. Why is Paula Schultz the grave? And I think it's just, he's probably a fan of this movie that's probably unwatchable, you know, because it stars, like, Colonel Klink and all these people, is, like, this 1968 movie called the crazy dreams or the dream state of Paula Schultz or something. It's very bizarre.
It's great, though, like what little rabbit holes Tarantino movies send you down, because if you like this thing, you want to start seeking out these other movies that he's riffing on.
Yeah, well, even like in the world of Quentin Tarantino, I know other directors obviously have their universes. Kevin Smith is kind of famous for really trying to create this skewniverse, the Viewisk universe, where he has all of his characters and all the movies have like a linear connection to each other and stuff.
Right.
Where different characters like that were in Clerks, obviously played by different actors in later movies, but like they're in the same universe. And he tries so hard to make that happen. And it works, and I'm not complaining about it. But Quentin Tarantino achieves that so effortlessly. And even so much that his like themes, like you mentioned the Acuna brothers, as like this thing, and Red Apple Cigarettes, obviously. And as Uma Thurman arrives in Tokyo, there's a billboard for Red Apple Cigarettes. But the billboard is the model is Sophie Fittell. Julie Dreyfus, who is so foxy in this too. By the way, I thought it was Monica Bellucci at first.
She looks a lot like her.
Yeah,
mushy mushy.
And she's trilingual, and it's perfect. And yeah. I don't think Lucy Liu speaks Japanese, and she does a pretty good job.
Yeah,
of that.
Yeah, she's good. And again, I wouldn't anticipate her being good, but because I'm not the world's biggest Lucy Liu
fan. No, because you see her in stuff like Charlie's Angels, Full Throttle, and it's like, well, right. you're a cute girl, and you know.
But again, he sees something in all these actors, and he knows exactly what to pull out of each of them.
Right.
Which is a real talent, and he's successful. I mean, I don't feel like it's really backfired yet, and maybe I'm wrong, but like some people would argue putting Zoe Bell in Death Proof was a mistake because she's not an actor. She's not very good.
Who
but
would
like
argue that,
A,
though?
The crazy style of acting is great, and B, you know, the real reason he cast her was so he could put one of the actors on the hood of a car as it's driving really fast, and that it's super effective.
Oh my god.
Do you have a favorite like sequence or set piece in all of the movies?
In the both Kill Bills, I don't know if I do, and it's only because, and I have to be honest, I have not seen these. I've probably seen the entire thing 2.5 times.
Okay.
Because I think I've seen the first volume 3 times and the second one
twice. So you've seen the entire thing twice?
Yeah.
Is what you're saying.
Yes, but I've seen the first one more than that, and it's like, yeah, the scene in Pasadena where she fights, I mean, it's such, as you pointed out before, it's such a shoulder grabber. It's like, you're going to be sucked in, like, she gets into Vernita's house, and it's like they're fighting, and it's like very violent, and this crashing, and I have to like lower my volume on my TV because it's like so loud and great. That obviously sticks out to me, but right now I'm thinking of the whole thing as a whole, and of course, because I saw, you know, like, I didn't watch them exactly back to back, but I took like an hour and a half break between the two, but I'm really thinking about volume two more because I would like to say, to your point about how Volume 1 obviously is the more, it's even rated higher on like IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes and stuff, that movie is like slightly more well-received. It's actually made more money, it's in box office and stuff like that. Because there is a kind of critique, I wouldn't call it a complaint, of the second one being definitely more character-driven.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, if you're like on this high of expecting the second one to be like the first one, you have to get over that. Because once you watch the second one, you realize things are uncovered in it that are so, I don't know, like, I love the whole Pai Mei thing, you know, when she's training and things like that. It's just so, like, it's out
there.
And plus
what that builds to, of her getting out of the coffin, and the way that moment builds is so great, partially because of the music, which is all incredible throughout the movie. And I like that during those moments, I mean, she has all these crazy things where she's in the back of the car trying to get her foot to move, and she's in the coffin, and she has these, like, moments of self-reflection. And I like that he uses those opportunities to fill in backstory also.
Right.
It's amazing that if he originally planned this as one movie, it's ballsy to like put the House of Blue Leaves essentially halfway through the movie, the biggest action sequence. Most movies end with their biggest action sequence.
That, to your question, I think that's probably the scene that sticks out most in my head because that scene is so fucking,
I could watch that scene
perfect.
A million times.
I mean,
the
action, everything about that, the music, the way it looks, the colors, it's really, really well done.
Although I'm not as big a fan of the black and white. I know some people prefer the black and white, and supposedly in the whole Bloody Affair, the uncut version, it doesn't do that switch to black and white. And I think that was a ratings thing more than anything else.
You know, I think today, it's funny, on Twitter today, Keith Phipps, I think it was...
From the AV Club?
From the AV Club, I think, commented on how he heard in the whole Bloody Affair that it's color. And he was kind of like, you know, I'd almost prefer it to be black and white because it's, you know, it means more. It just, it looks good to me. Mm-hmm. And people commented back to him saying like, well, you know, it's a ratings thing. It's a, so, Twitter is such a fucking nightmare because everyone is like so quick to like judge or correct or just right. be a dickhead. And he's just expressing this opinion. Like I heard that in the whole Bloody Affair that just was just shown this week, you know, it's color. And people are like, no. And he's like, no, I know that it's a ratings thing. Just like Psycho is, they could have definitely done color when that came out, but they chose not to so they can get away with a little more blood. Mm-hmm. That's the case too. But he's like, I like the way it looks. And I don't know. I don't have an opinion about it.
It doesn't bother me, but it is always a little bit jarring when it switches because I'm aware of the switch.
Yeah.
You know,
if nothing else, I'm actually more aware. Well, Quentin Tarantino, two things. One is that he does a lot of the black and white to color to black and white.
Yeah.
Not a lot, but I know in Death Proof it was just like unnecessary.
Well, and again, I feel like Kill Bill begat that. So right. If it hadn't happened, maybe he wouldn't have done it in Death Proof. But thank God that scene is not in the Grindhouse cut.
And then there's a scene too where it's black and white. She's outside the church in El Paso, the Twin Pines or Two Pines Church. And her
Twin
eyes,
Pines is Back to the Future.
Twin Pines, I think it's Lone Pine Mall. And her eyes and her earrings are the only thing in color. It's like a bad wedding photographer from 2001, where it's just like, I'm going to do everything black and white, except your flowers will pop, they're red. It's like, okay. So, I mean, I think that's way worse than like a black and white sequence. But, you know, it's something else that sticks out to me too. And it's not my favorite sequence because I don't dig on this style. It's not, and I say this acknowledging that I'm not the right audience for this, but it's so amazing to watch and really interesting is the whole anime sequence.
Renishi.
Her backstory. It just, of course, it has to be anime because it's the most violent fucking thing.
Right.
And of course, it's like a little kid watching her parents die, but it's like, it's done in such a way that's like, well, that's everything that I've seen. And again, my knowledge of anime is very limited, but it's everything that I've seen. It's just like, that's perfect, you know?
Right. And the music helps a lot. And again, I mean, the movie stops and for 10 minutes devotes itself to the backstory of a character that, you know, is really only in a handful of scenes. And right. The other people in Assassination Squad don't get that much of a backstory.
Right. And it's funny because it's like, would they do that not right before, but pretty much right before she gets, you know,
right.
killed by the bride.
Right.
And that's a great, I mean, that fight at the end too, where they have that's another scene that sticks out. It's the whole, I kind of lumped that the whole Blue Leaves, House of Blue Leaves sequence. But like when they're fighting in the courtyard
right.
and it's snowing and that water fountain or the waterfall sound effect. And she said, I think Lucy Liu says something like, if you have 5 minutes, you won't last with me.
Right.
And the bride kills her. And I read this at 4 minutes and 59 seconds. That's when the bride kills Lucy Liu's character. And again, it's a testament to Quentin Tarantino even having that in the back of his mind,
right.
working with Sally, whatever her name is, the editor, to like fit this to make it work.
Right.
Unbelievable. What do you think about Quentin Tarantino's use of like fake slow motion? I see it was done a couple times in this.
It doesn't bother me because, again, I think it's sort of...
deliberate?
It's deliberate.
Yeah.
That it's not... It wasn't a mistake that he's like, ooh, now I want to slow that down. I think it's more that's a stylistic thing
right.
that he remembers from these movies in the 70s that he's like, oh, I got to do this thing.
You know, it's interesting. We talked about this. I don't know if we've talked about this on a podcast before, but I do have a huge problem with directors. When you watch a movie that's very slick and very well... or not... a well-done movie, a well-executed movie, and... one of the last sequences, it's like a slow motion effect when they kill the villain. It's like, what the, you know, come on.
Right.
You're a director, you're you've got hundreds of people working on this picture. So basically you've got these professionals that this is their job to do this and they can't think enough ahead to overcrank the footage so that it's a smooth slow motion. Like it just seems so cheap. But to your point, I think that, I keep saying to your point, so please shoot me in the brain. I think it is stylistic because it's the same thing with all of his zooms, which is a very 70s thing that is not used very often anymore because when it's used now it's almost jarring, like who zooms anymore? It's always push in and pull outs, you know?
Right. Every time I watch it I get excited because like I think about the sequence that's coming up next, you know what I mean? When they land in Tokyo, I know that like, ooh, House of Blue Leaves is coming up and I get super excited.
Right.
But I even love all the stuff with
Sonny Chiba.
Yeah. I mean that whole scene is so great.
Yeah, I like that whole scene. It's almost like, and I think this again is deliberate, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's they're speaking Japanese in a way that no one speaks Japanese.
Right.
That they're speaking the way Americans perceive Japanese movies to as they shout towards each other in right. this kind of like right. very demonstrative way, like right. you get the sake, why do I have to? I'd be a millionaire by now. And it's so like exaggerated, and it's like it is so perfect because right. it's like, well, yeah, if they just said like, please get the sake, it wouldn't be interesting. But he makes it like all of a sudden you care about this ball, and it sticks out in your head as like this, you know, great scene.
Yeah, it's just it's the kind of movie that you can only make if you have this crazy encyclopedic knowledge of certain kinds of movies. I mean, right. he's seen everything, obviously, but it's very specific kinds of movies that really stick out in his mind, and they're very sort of visceral movies that are very like obvious in what they're going for. Yes. You know, there's nothing subtle about them, and that's what he's responding to, and that's what he's trying to recreate.
Yeah. The whole movie is if you haven't seen it, I don't know why you're listening an hour into this podcast if you haven't seen Kill Bill, but do yourself a favor and watch all of Quentin Tarantino, his entire filmography, go check out, and yeah. specifically this, because I think that you're right. I think that this is something that maybe is kind of not skipped, but just kind of watched quickly to get to Inglourious Basterds or to, you know, Pulp Fiction, and kind of like that's the, those are the centerpieces. And rightfully so, because those movies are great. I think Inglourious Basterds is easily one of the best movies of the last decade.
Yeah.
But this movie is up there as just being such a passion project, and just something that I appreciate that this person has such you know excitement for this the genres that I would never even know right. without right. without him.
And you know, with there's obviously plenty of people who just have no use for Quentin Tarantino, and that's fine.
No, well, you need to go walk off a bridge.
It's, you know, whatever. It's fine. We don't agree there. But with a lot of other directors, you know, if you're talking about like Steven Spielberg, and when you ask people like, what's your favorite Spielberg movie? You know, the guy has 20 something movies or something. And for the most part, it's going to come down to like one of four or five. And I think that's the way even, you know, Scorsese, I think that's the same with a lot of directors. And maybe it's because Tarantino only has a handful of movies. He hasn't made as many as other people. But I think if you ask, you know, 10 different people, what's your favorite Tarantino movie, you would get 10 different answers.
Right.
And, like, they're all kind of valid. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
The only one I would, if somebody said Reservoir Dogs, I'd be like, really? Even though Reservoir Dogs, by the way, is awesome.
You know,
I think and I understand it being someone's favorite.
It would be the person saying that, though, that is like, I think I said it for a while in almost response to Pulp Fiction before, obviously, his right, career right. built.
I liked his early stuff.
Right, like right. Reservoir Dogs. And Reservoir Dogs, if you really think about it, like, he had not a lot of resources. Obviously, yeah. Harvey Keitel, like, really backed it, and there's this movie that's made based upon serendipity and just, you know, financial backing, and, like, really the stars aligning for this movie to be made. Kind of like with a lot of movies, like, even Clerks, which, obviously, the making of Clerks wasn't a star alignment prospect, but the release and the subsequent acceptance at Sundance and things like that definitely was. Just it's all just like luck and good gravy. You could make the best movie ever, and if you don't have the right person seeing it, you're fucked. But this was like Reservoir Dogs was his early thing that was like his, and it was there's something small about it and very. I related a lot to like Death Proof in a way that not at all like stylistically or you know thematically, but just how. It's about a very specific subject or no subject at all. I mean, just it is what it is, and it's really a movie you see and you love and you kind of cheer about and get freaked out about, and then it's over, you know. And
it's great, but to me, it just feels like that it was a step towards what he would eventually be capable of, and I like the later movies better because he had gotten so much better.
You know, what's funny though is like I agree completely in as much as. You're right, because Pulp Fiction is so great, and all these other movies, and Kill Bill is so great. But can you imagine if that was the only thing he made? It would be this I don't know, just like this, like a rock star that died prematurely, like a Jimi Hendrix right. type. It's like, holy right. shit, have you missed? Have you seen this movie? Like, right. what would he have become? And we're lucky enough to realize what he became, and what he became right. is fucking awesome. So
there are moments of humanity in Reservoir Dogs and in Pulp Fiction, but I think overall they lack the humanity that like he really found in Jackie Brown, but that I think is there very much so in Kill Bill that he doesn't get credit for, and in Inglourious Basterds too. But I think, you know, again, people write off Kill Bill as just this sort of exercise in violence and copying styles, but I think there's a lot a lot of humanity in it.
Well, he also couldn't have made Kill Bill when he made Reservoir Dogs because, I mean, picture, I think he was born in 63, Reservoir Dogs came out in 92, so he was in his late 20s.
Right.
A late 20-year-old is not going to write Kill Bill.
Right.
I mean, you got to be in your, like, late 30s.
Even though I suspect, like, part of it was in his head, you know?
I think that with
him... He hadn't really come up with, like, the bride character yet, but you know, when he gets to certain movies, he's like, oh, I can finally do this thing that I've been thinking about for 15 years,
right,
you know?
Right.
And there's a lot of that in Kill Bill. Just, I can finally, even if it's just, I can finally reference this movie with this weird shot or whatever, you know. There's tons of, like, De Palma references in Kill Bill, and he hadn't really referenced De Palma up to that
point. The whole
sequence
where she goes to the bathroom, and it's, like, this big tracking shot and stuff.
Right,
it's,
and a lot
it's
of the...
right out of Snake Eyes.
The split screen shots and stuff.
Oh, when they're both, they punch each other, and it's, like, their bodies fall? Right. Oh, my God, that scene is, like, I don't know, it's so great. So
we love Kill Bill. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And remember, if you want to email us, fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. If you want to tell us what your favorite Tarantino movie is and why, or your favorite sequence in the Kill Bill movies and why. Maybe we'll read it on a future podcast.
I think I turned that into a Rush song.